This season, let your shoes do the talking. Designer Shoe Warehouse is packed with fresh styles that speak to your whole vibe without saying a word. From cool sneakers that look good with everything to easy sandals you'll want to wear on repeat, DSW has you covered. Find a shoe for every you from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, New Balance, and more. Head to your DSW store or visit DSW.com today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Some people play by the rules, but the real game changers break them. I'm Soraya, and on Rule Breakers, we're talking to the risk takers, the rebels, and the ones rewriting the playbook. Follow and listen to Rule Breakers with Soraya on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is 7:14 on a Tuesday morning. It's pretty nice, but who knows what's going to happen later on today. Some flooding in Algiers yesterday and on the West Bank in Gretna, also in the Ninth Ward. And there's a chance for rain today, 50% chance for rain. And Peyton Malone, WWL Louisiana Forecast Center meteorologist, telling us he can't really tell you where or when if that's going to happen again. So you just got to pay attention, I guess, and hope that it doesn't rain for a long time in the same spot. Because if it does, the streets are going to flood because we're underwater. But I guess we're under sea level. I guess we all know that by now. Highs of 83 today, 50% chance for showers. Pretty much same thing tomorrow. But then, just in time for Zurich Classic and Jazz Fest, clears out, sunshine, highs in the mid-80s. So get out and enjoy that. We're talking about sugarcane now with Kenneth Gravois, a sugarcane specialist with the LSU Agricultural Center. He works at the Sugar Research Station in St. Gabriel, Louisiana. How you doing, Kenneth?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. Thank you for having me.
Tell me about sugarcane, and you would think that, first of all, how big of an industry is it to Louisiana?
You know, sugarcane is our number one valued row crop in Louisiana, so it's really important to the rural communities here in the southern rural parishes, so that's what fuels those economies.
Do you have any idea how many jobs or how many people are dependent upon sugarcane in Louisiana and what kind of role it plays in Louisiana's economy percentage-wise?
Yeah, so, you know, estimates from the American Sugarcane League tell us that we employ somewhere in the neighborhood of 27,000 people in this industry.
Wow. Have things changed? Tell me about LSU's role in this, and have things changed when it comes to sugarcane? Because you would think, all right, you plant it in the ground, you grow it like you did in the 1800s or 1700s, or I guess however. How far does the history of sugarcane go back?
Well, you know, the history of sugarcane goes back to the history of Louisiana. It was first brought in to Louisiana in 1699 when Iberville came up the Mississippi River and first settled a place called New Orleans. You might be familiar with that.
But, yeah, I've heard of it.
You know, yeah, you've heard of it. So, but the you know, the role of LSU in all of this is that when you're growing a crop, any agricultural crop, there's two things that we want to accomplish. One, we want to create yield, and we want to improve yield over time. Prices can become stagnant, but we can control the yield in the field. So think about the role of research. We develop new varieties of sugarcane, and to give you some perspective on the impact of that, my dad was born around 1930, and from 1930 to 1970, he's raising six kids in St. James Parish, and the yields doubled because of research at LSU, USDA, wow. Support from the American Sugarcane League. Well, he passed away at the end of 2023, and the yields doubled again. So within his lifetime, through the research efforts within the industry, he's seen yields double and double again. He grew up and raised his family as a sugarcane farmer.
How do you go about increasing yield?
So we have breeding programs. These are programs that develop new varieties of sugarcane. So we grow parents in these hybridization facilities, and we make these new varieties and elite parents flower, and then we make crossing combinations. We have male and female parents, and then once we get seed set, we germinate those seeds, and we begin a 12-year process to create new genetics, new varieties of sugarcane. So, you know, we use that to increase yield primarily. Not only yield, but the number of crops that we can grow from a single planting, because we can get multiple crops from that planting.
Do we grow as much as we can sell? And if we could grow even more, could we sell even more? And how do imports factor in all of this?
Yeah, good question. We don't produce enough sugar in the U.S., so we do have imports that come in to fill that gap. We used to have sugarcane production in Puerto Rico. It went out in the 1990s due to high costs. Hawaii went out of production in 2016 due to high costs. And Texas went out of sugarcane production in 2023 for the same reason. So the only two states growing sugarcane now are Florida and Louisiana. And the Louisiana industry has been expanding its acreage both northward and westward. And that's the result of good genetics, good varieties, and a decent price.
Yeah, I was in Hawaii a long time ago, maybe 10 years ago, and I saw a lot of sugar places that were shut down. And what made it so expensive, and why was Louisiana able to prevail?
Well, you know, places like Hawaii and Puerto Rico are islands, so to get all of your inputs into those areas is very expensive. And those are big tourist destinations, just like you took a trip to the islands. Mm-hmm. I always tell people that, you know, sugar per acre of cane cannot compete with tourists per acre.
Yeah, that makes sense. It really does. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back talking to Kenneth Gravois, sugarcane specialist with the LSU Agricultural Center, works at the Sugar Research Station in St. Gabriel, Louisiana. Sugarcane's a $4 billion industry for Louisiana. LSU plays a big role in keeping it strong. If y'all have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. We wanted to have him on because, you know, we drive through parishes, river parishes and so forth, and we see the sugar cane growing, and then during the fall we see it harvested. And I think we take that for granted, just how much it contributes to Louisiana. Although, you probably shouldn't eat that much of it. 720 traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Kenneth Gravois, sugarcane specialist with the LSU Agricultural Center, works at the Sugar Research Station in St. Gabriel, Louisiana. I'm sorry about the loss of your dad, Kenneth, but you said he was a sugarcane farmer for how long?
Oh, all his life. His father farmed, and he and his five other brothers farmed sugarcane in St. James and some of the surrounding parishes.
What was that like for you? And I'm getting some text here because people are texting and they want to know about sugarcane. We like to educate people and we'll ask the questions. But I just got to ask you, you know, as a kid that grew up in the suburbs and rode his bike and everything and didn't have any farm duties or anything, what's it like to grow up on a sugarcane farm? And I presume you are still a farmer or not?
No, so I work with the LSU Ag Center, so I do research. But my brothers farm, and I have nephews, cousins. It's a family farming industry, and growing up on a farm is there's no better way to grow up than be on a farm, and you know, see things grow and thrive in a local community.
So what do you have to do? You know, we see the stalks rising, and then we see it in the fall get harvested and everything. What do you have to do in between the time you plant it? Just water it, or is there a lot of maintenance involved in growing sugar cane?
Oh, it takes a lot of tending. There's a little bit of cultivation. You know, we have to build up rows. We grow cane on beds because you talked about weather and all the rain in New Orleans yesterday. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we have to get water off these fields. We have to fertilize them. You get hungry, the plants get hungry, so they get a fertilizer application. We will control the weeds, and then Mother Nature and the sugarcane plant take care of themselves. I mean, we have bred these plants to be adapted to Louisiana temperate climate. You know, this crop is tropical in origin. It really shouldn't be growing in Louisiana, but never bet against Louisiana because we'll always find a way.
Somebody texted in about exports and tariffs and all of that. Does that apply to anything with the sugarcane industry?
So we import roughly about 15% of our needs here in the United States, and those exports are controlled through trade agreements. Mexico and Canada have free access to our sugar market. We have world trade agreements with maybe 140 other countries that have a quota and access to our market. So it's a controlled market. The price does not fluctuate a lot because we control the supply coming into the country. And normally we have more than enough sugar to satisfy the needs of the consumers here in the U.S.
Somebody texted in, what do you see in the future related to precision agriculture and the harvesting of sugarcane? And I'll piggyback on that with you. Talked about the doubling and then the doubling again of yield. How far can this go?
You know, I was talking to a group maybe a month or two ago and mentioned about the doubling and the doubling again. And it says, well, boy, you've probably reached the top. And I'm like, no. It seemed impossible to my father probably at those times that you could double the yield of sugar. And I say, why not double it again? I mean, that's the role of science. Science is an arena where you can assume some risk in order to innovate. And so, you know, we have, you know, world-class breeders and geneticists that are constantly, you know, building and designing better adapted varieties with higher yield potential. So I don't know, the future is bright. You know, we've overcome a lot through science, and I don't see why that trend has to stop now.
None of that's cheap. Do you have the funding for the research that you want to do in terms of doubling again, or maybe even doubling that?
So, I mean, the way research is funded, you know, LSU is a public state institution. We get funded by the state legislature. We have a federal research facility, a USDA research facility in Houma, Louisiana. And the growers, you know, contribute monies to the American Sugarcane League, and they fund a lot of their research. So, you know, there's kind of a diversity in our funding, and that helps when there's ebbs and flows in those funding streams. But, you know, that three-legged stool has served us for over 140 years, and that's been our recipe for success. So we're optimistic in this industry.
Very interesting conversation. Thank you, Kenneth. Always something to learn. Kenneth Gravois, sugarcane specialist with the LSU Agricultural Center, works at the Sugar Research Station in St. Gabriel, Louisiana. We'll talk with Fred Lopez when we come back about measles, about this 60 Minutes thing. I don't know if you saw it or not, about bird flu, H5N1. We'll talk about that and more when we return. Right now, time for WWL First News. 45, quarter till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. If you saw 60 Minutes on Sunday night, if you saw the story about the bird flu, I would think it got your attention, maybe for a couple of different reasons. I don't know. We're going to talk about it with Dr. Fred Lopez. That and measles, Dr. Fred, our friend, infectious diseases specialist at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. Let's talk about measles. Dr. Fred, how are you? Lopez. Hey, Doc, how are you?
I am okay. Yourself?
I'm okay. I'm vaccinated. I'm good to go. I'm feeling great. Let's talk about measles and cases in New Orleans. And I remember Bill Cassidy saying they were on the I-10 headed in from Texas. Tell me what the situation is with measles in the area, in the South, in the country, in the world.
Well, it's been a busy year with respect to measles. More than 800 cases reported in the U.S. so far this year, which is more than twice as many as all of last year. So a lot of cases. West Texas seems to be the hot spot, but it's spreading to other states as well. And in the last several days, we've heard about two cases of measles in the state of Louisiana, both from the New Orleans area, apparently both related to travel abroad in adults. And vaccination status of one is unclear and the other person was not vaccinated, which is typically the case when measles is diagnosed in the United States. It's typically an under-vaccinated or unvaccinated individuals.
Are you noticing, do we track vaccination trends? RFK took a step back and said after attending the funeral in Texas that the measles vaccine was the way to go. Do you notice any changes in the trends on that, or does it take a while for something like that to happen?
Well, no, we've been tracking it, and measles vaccination rates amongst kindergartners, for example, in the state of Louisiana, several years ago were around 95-96%. And in 2023-2024, the rates had dropped to 92%. Now, that doesn't seem like a very significant drop, except for the fact that herd immunity can be achieved with 95% or greater immunization rates. So when we drop below 95%, if a measles case gets into an under-vaccinated community where these vaccination rates are lower than 95%, we can see how it might spread amongst those individuals. And that's a concern. And so tracking these trends to make sure that we try to get above 95% is really, really important. And, you know, I think there is, as we've talked about many times in the past, there's a bit of vaccination fatigue. And when we've talked about it, it's been more towards COVID-19 vaccinations. But the reality is it's spilled over a bit to some other vaccine-preventable illnesses, including measles. And we're seeing the effects of under-vaccination or unvaccinated individuals being exposed to measles and getting infected with what could be threatening disease with potential for hospitalization and death.
And just for people that say, well, if you're vaccinated, why do I have to be?
Well, the reason you want to be vaccinated is you want to create a front of defense against the spread of measles. Some people who get measles may just have complications of fever, rash, maybe runny eyes, runny nose rather, and red eyes. But some people can develop severe complications, particularly infants, immunocompromised adults. These individuals, if they get infected with measles, they can develop really potentially fatal complications like brain swelling, pneumonia. And 1 to 3 individuals who are young who get infected with measles are going to die from measles. So this is something that we don't see it as frequently as we did before vaccination became available in the 1960s. Is still a big problem, and it's eliminated from the United States, but that doesn't mean we don't see it, and we're starting to see the effects again as unvaccinated or under-vaccinated individuals getting infected with measles. Again, more than 800 cases already reported this year in the United States.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up, talk about the 60 Minutes piece as it relates to bird flu. My concern is, if something like this happens, my concern is not scientific as much as it is political, if people are going to pay attention to it or not, or how likely the government is to do anything about it or not, if anything's to worry about. I don't know. We'll talk about it. But if you saw the 60 Minutes piece about bird flu, it was attention getting. 751, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:56, 4 till 8, couple of minutes left with Dr. Fred Lopez, infectious diseases specialist at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. 60 Minutes did about 15 minutes on bird flu. Dr. Fred, I would imagine as an infectious disease specialist, you have to look at the worst possible case, but then you have to factor probability into that. Tell me about bird flu and where we stand on this. I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes piece or not, but how concerned should we be?
Well, I think we should be concerned, and I think COVID-19 is an example of what can happen if we let our guard down and don't monitor the spread of a disease which has pandemic potential, which is always the case with new influenza strains. You know, right now, bird flu is considered a low public health risk as per the CDC, but that could change, and monitoring transmission of bird flu is really, really important. The real concern with bird flu is that the bird flu virus it can mutate and become more transmissible from human to human. Right now, there's no known person-to-person spread of bird flu in this country. And I just let me just repeat that, no known person-to-person spread. However, if a mutation occurred that allowed the virus to more easily transmit from human to human, that's when you would get very concerned about the risk for a pandemic. And that's what we need to monitor for. So far in this outbreak that's occurring in the United States, there have been 70 cases. And most of those cases of bird flu in this country have been mild. Maybe some conjunctivitis has been one of the more predominant manifestations of bird flu infections in this country. However, there has been one death, and that one death was in the state of Louisiana. But it was apparently in an individual that had a lot of other medical problems. So unclear if the death was directly due to the bird flu virus or due to complications from the other illnesses that this individual had. So there is the potential for severe outcomes. It is being detected. We know that it's being transmitted in poultry and cows as well. And we just need to monitor it to make sure that there's no human-to-human spread, because that's when the real concern is going to develop. Recognize as well that we do have treatments for bird flu virus infections. Same treatments that we use for human flu infections can be used to treat bird flu infections as well.
Scale of 1 to 10, how worried are you about this?
I'm worried, but I think that if we closely monitor these viruses for these mutations, I think we can stay on top of things. And because we've known about bird flu virus infections for years, we could develop a vaccine much more quickly than we did with COVID-19.
Scale of 1 to 10?
3.
Okay, good. Thank you, Dr. Fred. I appreciate it. That's layman's terms. Dr. Fred Lopez, infectious diseases specialist at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. We'll